Hi, and welcome to another edition of New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime. And today we have Peter Maguire on the line from the United States, and we're going to be talking about his new book, Tie Stick, Surfers, Scammers, and the Untold Story of the Marijuana Trade. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Oh, I'm great.
Fantastic. So as I was saying before in the pre-interview, we might just start off with a background about you and how you came to write what I got to say is the most fun book I've read since I've been doing these recordings.
Oh, well, thank you. I grew up in Southern California, and I was a lifeguard there. I moved to Australia in 1984, hoping to be a high-level competitive surfer, but coming up against the Ant Corrigans and the other great Australian surfers of that era, I quickly learned it wasn't going to happen and went to college, earned my PhD in history, and became a war crimes investigator in Cambodia, and stumbled across the confessions of four Americans captured and killed by the Khmer Rouge. Everyone suspected that they were CIA agents, but I knew that they were Thai marijuana smugglers, having grown up in Malibu and at a time when the Thai marijuana fleet came every single spring, and we, you know, waited for it like the arrival of the Beaujolais Nouveau.
Yeah. Yep. You start off with a book with great stories about what it was like in the surfing community in the West Coast when you were a kid. Do you want to explain that to everyone? Because I think it's an important part of building this culture before we get into the criminal aspects of your book.
Sure. No, I think, you know, it was a harsh code. We grew up in a very localized area, and you were expected to carry your weight and behave and accord yourself to certain standards that, you know, not only were you supposed to live by, but you were supposed to maintain if others didn't. And, you know, there were similar standards in Hawaii and Australia. And, you know, it was a subculture that was basically ready made for the marijuana smuggling industry because it was network marketing at its best. And so surfers, even, you know, Mike Hinson from Endless Summer, learned very early on that a few nervous hours would make for, you know, months and months of endless summer. And so marijuana and surfing kind of went hand in hand. And everywhere there was good waves, there was marijuana.
Yeah. And the lifestyle itself was extremely laid back by the looks of it. It was every small beach had its own particular culture. And you're even talking about how you as a young surfer were taking on some things that the older surfers looked down on, like leg ropes, for example.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Coot cord.
Yeah.
You know, I talk in the book about, you know, getting this great tube ride and coming out of it and thinking I was, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread. And this old weather-beaten local paddling up and staring at me and saying, oh, that's great. Oh, you got a leash. No, don't get me wrong. I think those are great. Every kook should have. and that was, you know, that was the world we grew up in. You know, the stand-up paddle boards, God help them. I mean, they would have been crucified on those sweeper paddles. And, yeah, it's amazing how much it's changed, you know. Australia, it had its own idiosyncrasies. I would say it was a much more democratic surf culture. If you were a great surfer and you were a dickhead, you were still a dickhead, which I liked about it.
Yep.
And it was great. I mean, it was great. I just, I, you know, the days I spent with, you know, Ant Corrigan and Matt Elk and that group down at Bondi and some of the others up in Byron, you know, I won't ever forget.
I suppose part of the difference in culture here was there are a lot fewer surfers for a lot more beach as opposed to in the U.S.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just, you know, surf spots that my Aussie friends would drive by, you know, my eyes were popping out of my head. Ah, nobody surfs that. Ah, that's, you know. And, yeah, it was just amazing.
Yeah. But the lifestyle of a priority of surfing and everything else had to fit around that, created a the incentive to actually build up this big pile of cash in a one-off transaction that allowed you to go back to the lifestyle.
Well, the irony of it was when I first went to Australia in 84, you know, and Bob Hawke was in office, my buddies were living large off the dole.
Yeah.
And he's like shaping a few boards, glassing a few boards, but they all had houses and cars and went to the pub every night.
Yeah.
So it was a generation, about a half a generation past us, and there were some heavy characters in Byron, and I remember some of my older friends saying, whatever you do, just stay away from them. And you know, as it's a well-established fact, much of the early Thai marijuana came into Australia, and it was such an easy, unprotected, vast amount of coastline.
And still is.
Initially, they would come into Darwin and drive it across, and that was a standard scam. You know, bring the Thai sticks into Darwin, load them up, drive them to Sydney. And then it just got much, much bigger than that. And, you know, you have the, you know, Murray Riley, the New South Wales detective, and the famous Ocker Nostra. Just remarkable stories. You couldn't even make them up.
All this still goes on today. It's just slightly better protection than it was before, but you wouldn't call it effective. As you can probably see, we have the plane they're searching for at the moment, and they said there's 12 Australian planes looking for them. That's probably all of our planes. So now's the time to bring drugs into Australia. I mean, there's no one left.
Well, that's the funny part. I mean, the Australian Coast Guard, or I don't know what the official name was, but they had two patrol boats from, you know, from the Northwest Territories to WA or something like that.
Further than Vancouver to Baja, California, and there's two boats.
And so, you know, these guys were sliding right in. A few of them were put the tie sticks in weighted barrels that they would attach to the keel, bring them into Darwin, and then offload them, and then, you know, drive them around. But, you know, there's just remarkable stories that nobody's even gotten to the bottom of, like, you know, Nugan Hand and Ocean Shores and, you know, there's that famous valley where the, you know, Italian immigrants in Australia moved.
Yes, and Orange. It's called Orange is the town. Yeah. It's the Ndrangheta. Yeah.
And there was the murder of the one Australian anti-pot guy that kind of kicked the whole thing off. I forget the year of that.
Yep, that was in the 70s,
Yeah, but it's, you know, this is it. I mean, this is the same story that we're seeing throughout my book and in America today even, and that is, it's a Pyrrhic victory. It is that you win the battle and you lose the war, and that, you know, in America, okay, marijuana, they made some gains on it, but it was replaced by methamphetamine, and now we have this absolute scourge of pharmaceutical drugs where more people are dying from that than almost anything else in America, and it's legal, so people sort of turn a blind eye to it. You know, in Australia, you know, you get replacement drugs far worse than, you know, the original article.
Oh, yeah. We definitely have exactly the same problem with meth. Meth has exploded here. And the motorcycle gangs are pretty heavily involved in that as well. Yeah.
It's a vile. Ask any cop what they'd rather deal with, and they just roll their eyes. You know, they want to deal with pot smokers. You know, meth heads are scary and dangerous.
Yep.
And you know, the DEA guys I interviewed in the U.S. They said, look, you know, these guys were quote fun cases to work.
Yep.
These guys were smart. They traveled to nice places, and above all, quote, you didn't have to worry about them pulling a gun on you.
No.
And you know, they were totally nonviolent. The Australian trade, not so much. I mean, you get the Mr. Nice gang, and the most horrific thing about Australia is the police, especially in Queensland, they make huge gains on marijuana in the early 70s, and then it's replaced with China white heroin. And you have, a generation of Gold Coast superhero surf stars just decimated. And nobody is more articulate in talking about that than Robert Bartholomew. Mm. And Robert Bartholomew's book is heartbreaking, where he talks about losing, I don't know how many friends, but it's something absurd, 6 to 10 friends in a couple of months from heroin.
It's the surfing equivalent of the AIDS invasion in the 80s, where AIDS was decimating the arts community, and this was decimating the surfing community.
Yeah, and what's interesting, as a Californian, heroin was something, I was around all kinds of drugs and everything, but heroin was just beyond the pale. Nobody ever thought about that or even considered doing it. And when I got to Australia, I was surprised that it was more common. It wasn't that common, but it was around. And then, it was much more prevalent down there than, in California.
Yeah.
When I was growing up. And look at your proximity to the Golden Triangle and all that. It only makes sense. Mm.
That's right. That's right. And we had a very large Vietnamese population that came over at the end of the Vietnam War with all those connections ready-made. That allowed
I think the book is The Crimes of Patriots, written by a former Wall Street Journal reporter about Nugan Hand and the Ocra Nostra and all that. And I looked at that book and I went off his footnotes and got the newspaper articles from Sydney Morning Herald and The Australian and stuff. And my goodness, I mean, that is just a book waiting to be
read. Yeah. Well, I'll put my hand up for that one. I'll start on that. I've got a couple others to finish off, but I'll jump on that. So, while Australia is a definite part of the story actually begins in California. And the reason why Australia gets into the story is because the story moves away from the United States to Southeast Asia, partly as a result of the hippie trail and partly as a result of people trying to even avoid conscription to the Vietnam War.
Right. Go ahead.
No, you're right. I was going to say, do you want to explain how that actually happened?
Well, the interesting real Thai marijuana trail is that in the very beginning, it was relatively small load, not much more than a few hundred pounds. And it would typically go from Thailand to Bali, where it would then sail from Bali to Northwest Australia, because that was the shortest route. And then that's where it would, transit once again. But, Australia was always just the easiest hop to bring a load of Thai. So it was, part of this equation from day one. And Australians... interesting as well, there were Australian workers, I think oil workers in South Africa in the late 60s that were smuggling, some excellent, world-class Durban poison and that kind of pot. Mm. But what's funny when you look at Australia, the seizure numbers for Australian customs are staggering compared to the United States. Like in 1969, they're still under 1,000 pounds for a whole year, So they're just so behind.
Oh,
and
that's
people
right.
can, slip it right through. They don't even know what they're looking for,
Well, I'm working on a book on corruption in my state, Queensland, and in amongst the material, they're talking about we're taking corruption from drug dealers. And they said, we went to a briefing in the 1980s saying that drugs are coming to Queensland, and they just laughed at them. Because even in the 80s, they didn't believe that there were many drugs around. And as you're saying, in the community, people were dying from heroin, but the police were completely ignorant of the whole situation.
Well, Queensland.
Yeah. Even for the ones, people who don't know, we refer to my state as the Deep North, just like they have the Deep South in the US. It's
a
very similar situation.
I'm speaking to you from North Kakalaka, as we like to call North Carolina. And so, you know, I guess I felt comfortable in Queensland, so I moved here. But, no, I remember the 4X beer and all that, you know. And are you the you're the Blues, not the Maroons, right?
I wear the Maroons. State yes, Queensland State. For the football team.
Okay, I think I've rooted for the Maroons in the state versus state, mate versus mate match.
Yep. And Billy Connolly, the comedian, loves to tell a story of the one time he did a concert in Queensland in the 1970s and how the police beat him up because he looked funny. And that was very much the way the police work. Very professional organization. But that movement from Thailand to Bali to Australia and then on to America as well, it's tied to the fact that not because there was anything special about Bali, other than the fact that that's where the surfers were. They were going there. So Bali didn't have any special characteristic other than it was a nice place to surf and a cheap place to live.
Yeah, but then, like I said, it's a straighter shot down. I think it's a sea of, the Beagle Sea or something. Yeah. It's not that. It's a pretty easy run, you know, compared to Thailand or, you know, any other, you know, they get to a first world Western country where they can, you know, sell it off to Australian organized crime or whatever. And it was an easy day, you know, compared to getting it to another transshipment point or whatever. They can unload it all there.
Yeah. Yep. And what effect did the Vietnam War have on the trade?
Well, you know, much like we were talking about before, same thing, Pyrrhic victory. We have American soldiers drafted going over there, anything to pass their time. Most of them are in the rear echelon. They're not in combat. And so, of course, they smoke pot. And then, you know, the U.S. government's under great congressional pressure to, you know, to cut down on the pot. Once Nixon gets elected, he wants the marijuana stepped on, and he does. And the net result is they have major gains in marijuana smoking, cutting all that out of the military. But South Vietnam's flooded with China White, you know, number four heroin and, you know, 90-something% pure. So, you know, the American soldiers in Vietnam and Thailand get completely strung out on heroin so pure all they need to do is smoke it and they get a habit. And that really begins the down spiral for the U.S. in the Vietnam War. I mean, so many middle-class American farm boys are going home junkies that it comes to the attention of the Senate and the president.
Yep. There's a great story about the president sending one of his envoys over to look into the drug situation.
Yeah. No, exactly. And they were, at least he was honest enough to admit it, that guy, you know, where he said, it's not I forgot the exact words. He was like, it's not a problem. It's a condition or something, but it's just so far gone, you know, just. And you know, and then you have generals and stuff saying, gosh, if I could just get rid of this heroin, I'd buy all the pot in the entire Mekong Basin to get these guys off this shit. And so that's where you love the military, because they're honest. You know, they got these guys, young kids, they're watching them get fucked up and strung out. And it's an American tragedy, you know?
Mm. But the surfers weren't involved in that trade, so they're sort of on the periphery of that, because really, I suppose, reading your story and then reading other people's books about drug smuggling, these weren't guys who want a regular deal. They would sort of do a run, make some money, and then go, oh, I think I need more money, I'll do another run. Is that more accurate?
Yeah, I think, you know, you have a bunch of surfers that initially are doing it to finance a lifestyle, and you know, they make their big hit and they go surf for a while, and they have a great, you know, they have a great deal. They work Thailand 3 months, 4 months a year. They're in Bali and Australia and Hawaii the rest of the time. But then, you know, the profits and everything else get ridiculous to where this stuff selling for $2,000 a pound in the 70s. And they, you know, everybody gets greedy and surfing becomes less important than, you know, than making a giant fortune. And some of these guys made fortunes. And, you know, the money corrupts it all, as it always does.
Yeah. Whereas at the other end, in the Thai villages, for example, they were just growing this stuff without any moral or legal preconceptions that there was an issue here.
You know, this is a medicinal herb that's in every northeastern Thai garden, and, you know, they put it in chicken soup, and they don't even really smoke it. So, you know, some do, but it's kind of an old man or a lazy person's drug. It's not, it's just not anything. It's not taken even seriously. The Thais were baffled when the Americans, you know, got such a hard-on about pot.
Yeah, yeah. I think they, if I remember correctly, the demand outstripped supply at one stage. There just weren't enough Thais growing it.
No, no, no. For most of it, because it's not Colombia, it's not Mexico. It's a finite crop, and there are various fixers and procurers in place. When it's gone, it's gone, and you have to wait till the next year.
Yeah.
And that goes on for a very long time. Towards the end, others, you know, get it a little tighter. But, you know, the real A-plus pie, when it's, you know, by far the, you know, best pot in the world, is 75 to about 78. And then it, you know, it creeps into the early 80s here and there, but it starts getting polluted by bad commercial Thai, where they're just, you know, trying to make money.
Yeah, yep. Do you want to talk about Mike Ritter, your co-author, and his story, how he got into it, and his eventual, demise, I was going to say.
Sure. Well, I, you know, as I had said earlier, I found the confessions of the four Americans at Tuol Sleng prison in Cambodia. I suspected they were pot smugglers. I used to surf amazing right point down in Baja. And as I was down there, I spoke to a couple of old surfers and was telling them about the story. They said, oh, yeah, we knew a couple of those guys who were killed in Cambodia. And this one guy, Mike Ritter, yeah, he really knows. He knows the whole story. Okay. And I hear that many times in my profession. And a couple of years later, I finally met Ritter, and I gave him the names. And within about less than 2 weeks, he came back with basically the whole story, who they were working with, the names of the boats, everything. And I kind of went, wow. And he, Ritter, had been a smuggler from the hippie trail in the 60s all the way through Thailand in the beginning in the 70s, all the way till about 85 he retired. And, you know, I trained him in oral history and taught him how to interview people and got him into Columbia University's oral history project, where they teach you how to interview. And he became one of the best. One of the best historians I've ever met, and really began to piece this whole story together from all different angles. And so his focus was mainly the smugglers, where I handled Khmer Rouge, you know, Southeast Asian police and militaries that had intersected with the marijuana smuggling trade, DEA, police, all that, and it was a great collaboration.
And he himself has moved through the career, as you said. Why did he leave the trade?
Because it got too criminal. He was an old hippie surfer, and basically, you know, he found himself dealing with, you know, gangsters and, you know, he avoided it. He didn't really consort with them or co-conspire with them, but he just saw the trade after the DEA busted the hippies and the surfers and all that, suddenly got flooded with serious gangsters, and he didn't want to deal with them. And so in, I think, 86, he finally had a big successful load, made about $5 million cash, retired. And then in 2003, I think, the DEA and Customs and IRS and all that, indicted him, and he wound up doing a little under 2 years of prison time.
Yeah. Took a while to catch him, though. Was that the DEA working backwards through informants or through old files, or how did they actually come to catch you?
No, you know, ironically, it was barely the DEA, and you know, we have a narrator in our book, DEA agent Jim Conklin, who's been a very generous supporter of the book, and you know, allowed us to interview him at length and this and that. And Agent Conklin actually, you know, really tried to help Ritter. And you begin to see a rift in the kind of pre 9/11 DEA and the post 9/11 DEA. And, you know, they kind of equated Ritter's situation to where, oh, you know, he's getting offshore money, you know, money laundering equals terrorism. So his case became more of a customs IRS case than a drug case. It was about money. And that's what they wanted. They wanted money. They didn't want information. By the time they got him, everybody had been busted and wrapped up, but they wanted cash.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was pretty gross, to be honest. You know, it was pretty crass. And that's, the next book is called Tie Stick 2, Law and Disorder, and it's about what I describe as this casino culture of jurisprudence, where you come in and you make a deal with the U.S. attorney, and you rat on this guy and you rat on that guy, and you know, and it's a joke. It's totally subjective, and some of these guys were good hustlers, and they got in and sang a good song to the DA and the judge, and they got off for nothing. And then, you know, the guys who actually held their mud, didn't talk, didn't rat on anybody, they made examples of.
Yeah. Well, that's the story of all great illicit organizations. The ones who can hold the line are pretty hard to touch. Even I do work with, on corrupt police. And it's the denunciation network, as Carlo Morselli from Montreal says, you know, when one rolls, there's a pattern to how the rest of them roll out. It's very fragile. It's a brittle sort of thing. If it all holds together, everything's fine. As soon as one goes, the rest are going to roll out eventually, because they have to compete to be the one who's going to get protection. They won't all get protection.
Yeah, it's the classic prisoner's dilemma.
That's right. Now, one of the most interesting things I found about quite a few of the books I've read of the trade in marijuana is the lack of violence in the trade. I know we've got the exceptions here in Australia with the Mr. Asia Syndicate, but certainly even Mr. Asia, when they were purely dealing with the marijuana, they still didn't have the violence then. So is it just the nature of the people who were involved in it that there was no violence, or was there just so much product that they didn't need to have violent competition?
No, it was the nature of the trafficker. These people got... You know, at a certain point, they're dealing with, you know, serious Thai gangsters and Chiang Kai-shek's, you know, former leaders. And they're basically saying, here's a suitcase worth more than that entire boat. Why won't you put this suitcase on that boat? You know, and it was still the smack. And they would say, no, you know, that's death. Those are death drugs. We don't touch those. And they were, you know, they really held the line. But what happened in Australia was you basically had the syndicates strong-arming the pot dealers and saying, you either sell this heroin or, you know, we're coming for you.
Yeah.
And I think Australia was just so innocent at that time to drugs, and surfers were bold and brash, and they thought they could handle anything. The American tide smugglers were, you know, very, very reticent to smuggle anything but pot. And we see that change by the early 80s. The DEA and Thai police start cracking down successfully on marijuana, but then, you know, the heroin trade explodes. And, you know, the heroin trade creeps into Australia, but in the United States, it remains somewhat separate.
And what really brings the end of this period of the so-called surfer drug trader? Is it just that there was one generation of them who grew up and they weren't getting replaced, or is it the market itself that sort of ends this type of trade?
Yeah, it gets much harder. It's basically, you know, it's yet another Pyrrhic victory, and that the, you know, the police get rid of the hippies and the surfers who are nonviolent, and the gangsters and true criminals replace them. And so, you know, suddenly they're dealing with, you know, former military guys running 200-foot boats filled with, you know, 20 tons to 40 tons, and, you know, it's a whole different game. And they're coming to the United States. I mean, by then, Australia is a secondary, you know, place to bring weed.
Is it that the surfers were actually being caught because they were so lackadaisical, they didn't have that criminal professionalism, so they were easier to catch? Were they the low-hanging fruit?
Yeah, they were softer. They, you know, the real, you know, the true gangsters, and there weren't that many of them, but, you know, they wouldn't talk. They would accept prison time as basically a occupational hazard, and the surfers weren't used to that. They weren't banking on going to prison, and so, you know, it just, they, you know, they got rid of the hippies, they got rid of the surfers, and the gangsters came in and played a whole different ballgame.
So maybe the police themselves were chasing the surfers because they were the easier targets, and as you say, the less violent ones. So your job was a lot more fun if you were dealing with surfers than dealing with a Mexican cartel equivalent.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, by the end, they're wanting weapons, they're wanting things that typically hadn't been serviced in the Thai marijuana industry.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but you see, you know, some pretty serious people by the end of it. I mean, the big load that ends the Southeast Asian marijuana trade in the United States is 72 tons on a single boat.
Yeah.
You know, captained by a former Green Beret. So, you know, and the weed had been loaded by the Vietnamese military out of Da Nang. So, you know, we're talking about true globalism.
Yeah, yeah. So in one sense, they were easy to catch. In the other sense, they were pushed out of the market because they just, competition was stronger. Who were they selling to once they got it to America? So who was buying it?
The good stuff would stay on the West Coast. And then the, you know, the less good stuff would go to the Midwest and the East Coast. They didn't know any better.
That's right. And you discuss in the book a group who were living on a ranch, who were living an alternative lifestyle, that some of the surfers had come into contact with, the Brotherhood. Yeah. Tell us about them.
Oh, you know, the thing about the Brotherhood that's fascinating is, I would call them a true utopian movement, you know, that fits into history with the Shakers or the Mormons or the, you know, I mean, these were true believers, and they basically set themselves up as a religion in 1968 that used LSD as a, you know, a sacrament as per the instructions of Timothy Leary, and they successfully imported more hash and LSD in the United States than any group in the 60s and early 70s. And, you know, they basically were a non-profit organization. They did not make anywhere near the money that they could make. And they basically believed that this was a religious sacrament, and they were, you know, true believers, as, you know, as it's called.
Yeah, and the big names of the counterculture were there. They were participants.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no, they were, you know, these were the elite of that counterculture. And, you know, Jimi Hendrix would go and stay and party with them and shag their girls. And, you know, they had a good run.
Yeah, well, they were having fun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, you've already mentioned you're doing a second book. What drove you to do this? Was it the frustration with that I've heard through the conversation about the way that things are running now?
Yeah. I mean, my real bread and butter is I'm a professional historian, war crimes investigator. My books are on the law and theory of war. That's what I teach at a university, but I feel like, you know, any number of us who live through this period kind of need to come clean as we're watching our nations get decimated by pharmaceutical drugs and a bunch of nonsense about marijuana. And, you know, I don't see marijuana as the great cure of everything as some of its advocates do, but you know, given where we are with pharmaceutical drugs and deaths by pharmaceutical drugs in the United States, it's time, you know, that people begin to look at this in a more reasonable way. I mean, it's absurd, really.
And what do your contacts think about the new laws in the U.S. now, like Colorado and other states?
Well, as I said previously, United States is basically where we were in 1975 at the end of the Vietnam War, where we're looking for a graceful exit, really where there is none. And the deaths in America from pharmaceutical drugs and from these synthetic opiates have reached a place where, you know, this is no longer political. It's just, you know, it's off the charts, and enough's enough.
Okay. Well, look, we might wrap it up there. Thank you very, very much for all your time. Sorry about our communication breakdown there in the middle.
Oh, no sweat.
But, Peter McGuire, thank you very much. And thank you for discussing your book, Tie Stick, which, as I said to everyone, I've read a lot of books while I've been doing these podcasts, but yours was certainly the most fun of any of the ones I've read. So I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's a great compliment. And I look forward to getting back to Australia soon and hope to have a pint with you.
Yes,
in
definitely.
An RSL at your choosing.
Oh, I think we'll choose the Byron Bay one. Just out of sentimentality.
All right. I'm very comfortable with it.
Excellent. Thank you.